Tie-Dye Everything, specializing in locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located behind Mikey's at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. You can also find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com. KRFP is also supported by
Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006, including 3 and 4 bedroom apartments and houses. For more information, you can reach Isaac at 208-882-6442 or ponderosarentals at hotmail.com.
KRFP, Moscow.
And you are listening to KRFP, Moscow. This is the Wild Clearwater Country Show. First, though, a little bit of the weather. It looks like much of the same. Oh, boy, we may end up with another 1910 fire season on our hands if we don't get some moisture in the next couple of months. Here we go. Partly cloudy. Tonight, lows about 45, highs tomorrow in the mid-60s. Partly sunny, partly cloudy, low about 40. Thursday night, mostly sunny, high about 59. On Friday, and mostly clear Friday night, low about 35. Mostly sunny Saturday, about 63 for the high. Low about 38 degrees Saturday night. And Sunday, partly sunny, high 67. And Sunday night, mostly cloudy. And looking into next week, there's about a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms on Monday and Monday night and into Tuesday. So we'll see if indeed a weather front does move through the area. Well, before I get into the program today, I thought I'd play a little bit of music here. And some music from KRFP here. Mickey and the Motorcars are sort of an alt-country group. And play a little bit of their music. It's kind of a sad reason. Their bass guitarist recently died on a tragic accident on the Salmon River. The group was originally from the Stanley area and moved to Austin, Texas. So maybe in the memory of Mark McCoy, we'll play a little bit of music here from Mickey and the Motor Cars.
I don't blame you for walking away. You'll be bitter off someday. If I had, girl, something good to say, don't you think by now I would have found a way? But baby, I won't forget you. And baby, I can't wish that I could. I was reckless leading you to believe you careless when you fell for me. Though I can't shadow dark when these clouds
Some hands need you to wipe away the tears. Baby, I won't forget you. And baby, I kinda wish that I could.
And we're back, the Wild Clearwater Country Show. A little bit of music there from Mickey and the Motor Cars. Playing that sort of in memory of Mark McCoy. He suffered a tragic accident on the Salmon River. He was fishing, and in the high water, he was in a raft, and they hit a submerged log, and he went down. They were a band, Mickey and the Motor Cars. I believe originally they formed in Stanley, Idaho, and moved to Austin, Texas. We'll be playing a little bit more of the music as we go on. But today, as a theme for the Wild Clearwater Country, I thought we would talk a little bit about the Clearwater itself and read from a book that is intended more as a celebration, although the title is a great title. It's taken from the creation story of the Nez Perce people. It's called The Heart of the Monster. It's a book by Rick Bass and David James Duncan, and Why the Pacific Northwest and Northern Rockies Must Not Become an ExxonMobil Conduit to the Alberta Tar Sands. And the reason I'm saying celebration is thus far, only one of the ExxonMobil loads, and it was a test load, was able to go over Highway 12 through the Clearwater Country, although unfortunately others made it through Moscow in a much chopped-down form. And now it looks like that they're not going to be offloaded at the Port of Lewiston anymore, but rather the Port of Pasco, and be going up through the panhandle of Idaho further north. On I-90, I think the reception that they got in Moscow, Idaho, and elsewhere sort of convinced them that they needed to look at other routes. But it's a celebration, a qualified celebration at that, with a bit of equivocation, because ExxonMobil is still around, still the richest corporation in the world, probably the most powerful entity on the planet. But nonetheless, a celebration, because they are not going up Highway 12 now, nor are they going through Moscow, Idaho, on Highway 95. So I'll start a little bit with a preface from this book, written by David James Duncan and Rick Bass. I'm going to be reading first the preface, but the book is called The Heart of the Monster. And I guess sometimes we do feel, it does feel that way, being in the situation we are globally, and a lot of the things that are going on the planet, seems like humanity is on a fast road to self-destruction from an environmental perspective and from an economic perspective and from a social perspective. So, but sometimes we need to just celebrate and dance some of the small victories. So here we go, from David James Duncan, and he starts off with a quote from Cormac McCarthy on the road. Once there were brook trout in the streams in the mountains. You could see them standing in the amber current where the white edges of their fins wimpled softly in the flow. They smelled of moss in your hand, polished and muscular and torsional. On their backs were vermiculate patterns that were maps of the world in its becoming. Maps and mazes of a thing which could not be put back, not be made right again. In the deep glens where they lived, all things were older than man, and they hummed of mystery. And This tells a little bit about the book itself. And David James Duncan begins, "This rapid response book exists out of love for things that cannot be put back, not made right again. Noble ways of life, forms of life, and beautiful places threatened. Big government and bigger oil, aided in Montana and Idaho by run-amok governors and paid-off politicians, are out to turn the Northwest's and Northern Rockies' iconic rivers, roads, and wilderness into a tentacle of the largest and most destructive petroleum project in history, the Alberta Tar Sands. ExxonMobil is leading the effort to convert 1,100 miles of riverways and scenic byways into a high-and-wide industrial corridor that will connect the tar sands to the industrial nations of the Pacific Rim, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and any other country with whom the multinational tar sands investors choose to do business, will then commence to deliver potential thousands of the largest, heaviest single objects ever to travel, even by ship, to Vancouver, Washington, transferred to barges and sipped up the Columbia and Snake Rivers to Lewiston, Idaho. From there, the mega loads, 230 feet long, some of them and seven times heavier than the 80,000-pound loads the roads were designed to support, will creep over 600 miles of the most cherished wild river and mountain roads in America, pass into Canada, and join forces with the worst CO2-spewing operation in history. These loads are headed for the wild and scenic Clearwater and Lockshaw Rivers in Idaho, over Lolo Pass through Missoula, Montana, over gas lines, sewers, bridges, and other fragile infrastructure, up the Big Blackfoot River, over Rogers Pass, and along the eastern front of the Rockies to Alberta. The same kind of loads carried by the same mammoth trailers coming here have crashed on level four-lane highways in Canada by simply breaking the steel of their giant trailers. Here they'll be traveling mountainous, icy, serpentine byways in the dead of winter and the dead of night, stopping all other traffic as they scrape alongside sheer granite and basalt cliffs, sending out unprecedented vibrations and avalanche zones that have swept semi-trucks into the rivers, damages to infrastructure, delay of emergency vehicles, serious disruption of local communities and tourists, and local communities and tourists, and economic loss because of these disruptions are certainties. Strip mining gear irretrievably dumped in the Clearwater, Lockshaw, Big Blackfoot River is a likelihood. And ExxonMobil's assurances to the contrary carry the weight of smoke. The company's history of environmental debacles, consistent lies and denials, criminal convictions, human rights atrocities, catastrophic oil spills, and junk climate science speak for themselves. And again, as I said, it's a celebration because luckily we kept them off there. The establishment of this tar sands tentacle will allow any big oil or Pacific Rim industrial interest to convert our region's Lewis and Clark Trail, Nez Perce Historic Trail, hometowns, pristine rivers, agricultural transportation routes, hunting, fishing, kayaking, skiing, and wilderness access into a high and wide industrial shipping route at will in perpetuity. We will have no local control over what foreign industrialists or big oil choose to shunt through our wilds. The first big financial beneficiaries of this hijacking will be ExxonMobil and a South Korean steel company. The first big financial losers will be the American people, and the economic losses pale beside cultural and spiritual losses that economists don't even know how to address. Worse, ExxonMobil's Northwest invasion is only the beginning. As the Alberta tar sands are fully exploited, thousands of miles of dangerous, poorly monitored oil pipelines will be run through America, crossing hundreds of our most important agricultural aquifers, rivers, wetlands, and farmlands, invading human and wildlife communities. One of the first such pipelines running from the tar sands through Michigan has ruptured three times since July 2010. The first leak spilled close to 1 million gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River and Lake Michigan, creating havoc. So that was the introduction and the preface to the book. I think he has done a good job. I'm going to skip the next chapter a little bit and go on here with at least the next section of the preface and go on here with kind of the concluding part. He says, "I've written an essay, Heart of the Monster, that tries to strike a balance between expose and spiritual solace, complete dossier on big oil's misdeeds in the tar sands alone would fill Yankee Stadium. It overwhelms. My intent and response is to warn of dangers, but also to try to keep hearts, including my own, awake to some of the inviolable sources of balance, creative action, and inspiration." So he continues on and he talks a little bit about some of the other things in the book. But I want to just conclude with this. We rest in the knowledge that we gave our best and worked out of deep gratitude and love. And I think that's an amazing statement from the author. So I'm going to take a quick musical break again and come back, and we're going to read actually from the essay, The Heart of the Monster by David James Duncan. But we're going to play a little more music here from Mickey and the Motorcars, and here we go.
Sunrise on you in Carolina, and it'll set on me in Tennessee tonight. I've had Carolina mornings and California nights. The times and places in between I found to be alright. Understood, I'll show up without a warning, and I'll love you on a Carolina morning. Tomorrow night I leave for California. After that I might go home to Idaho, but the sun will rise on you. It's on me, I just don't know. I've had Carolina mornings and California nights. Times and places in between I found to be alright. But it feels so good that it's understood I'll show up. Check out Music Row and Opryland and get to know my friends. But more than likely, I'll just show up without a warning, and I'll love you on a Carolina morning. I've had Carolina mornings and California nights. The times and places in between I found to be alright. But it feels so good that it's understood I'll show up without a warning, and I'll love you on a Carolina morning. Yeah, more than likely I'll just show up without a warning. Carolina morning.
And we are back, the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Taking a little bit of a musical break there to save my voice. We're reading from The Heart of the Monster by David James Duncan and Rick Bass. I'm actually reading the parts written by David James Duncan. Some of this essay and selections from his Heart of the Monster essay. And I'm reading it more in terms of celebration. No, tar sands are still being developed, is true. And it's a qualified celebration at that. But for the time being, the Clearwater is not going to be bothered by these massive loads, nor will citizens in Moscow. So here we go. Corporate welfare for ExxonMobil versus rivers, roads, and wilds for the American people. And that's the way he begins this part of the essay. A corporation, writes a Kentucky farmer and sage, Wendell Berry, is essentially a pile of money to which a number of persons have sold their moral allegiance. Interesting. It can experience no personal hope or remorse, no change of heart. It cannot humble itself. Its single purpose is to become a bigger pile of money. 2 years ago, the pile of money known as ExxonMobil set its sights on the Pacific Northwest and Northern Rockies. ExxonMobil's expressly amoral aim was to convert 1,100 miles of achingly beautiful rivers and roads through the heart of both regions into a so-called high and wide industrial corridor, or heavy haul route, connecting the Alberta tar sands to the industrialized nations of the Pacific Rim. The proposed conduit, if established, will be permanent. Its purpose will be to barge mega loads of giant strip mining modules and sand cooking machines and refinery gear outsourced by ExxonMobil to South Korea through the scenic heart of Oregon and Washington to Lewis and Idaho, load them onto the most gigantic trailers ever to attempt an American highway, and drag them along some of the most pristine rivers and mountain ranges in Idaho and Montana, then north to Canada and the Alberta tar sands, where they will set about destroying the earth. Later, megaloads could come from China, Vietnam, Singapore, Taiwan, or anywhere else big oil chooses. And God knows what the extractive industries might choose to ship in the opposite direction. The states, communities, river and wilderness users, residents, and wild creatures being invaded will be given no say. And that is usually how these things go. But people did raise their voice. Among the treasures slated to be pierced, built, culturally warped, integrated, are the Snake and Columbia Rivers, the historic, heartbreaking Nez Perce Trail, the epic-making Lewis-Clark Trail, the homelands of three sovereign Indian tribes, the Steelheaders Paradise, that is the Clearwater River, the Kayakers Paradise, that is the Lockshaw River, Montana's Bitterroot, Clark Fork, and Big Blackfoot River, of a river runs through it, fame. Two formidable mountain passes, Motorcycle Magazine's number one rated long-distance American joyride, and the Federal Highway System's number one rated scenic byway. Tourists en route to Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks, or to the largest group of contiguous wilderness areas in the lower 48, or to the Front Range of the Rockies, or to the Sturgis Motorcycle Fest, will now have to wait in line for hours, then dodge their way around police cars escorting 220-foot-long, 3 stories tall loads of tar sands, strip mining gear. The safety and character of scores of rural communities and 4 fabulous states will be seriously compromised. Thousands of sustainable jobs in the 2 states' leading industry, tourism, will be diminished or lost. The cultural travesties will be equally galling if ExxonMobil is allowed to convert the spirits of Chief Joseph, the slaughtered Nez Perce people, President Thomas Jefferson, and the Lewis and Clark expedition into tar sands lackeys in the afterlife. The politicians touting ExxonMobil's tar sands tentacle are careful never to mention the international repercussions. The Alberta tar sands are releasing so much CO2 that leading climatologists liken it to an act of war committed by Canada against itself and every other nation in the world. Conflict-free oil, Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer calls this product. I will eventually dispose of this claim in 2 ways, but I'll begin with a wake-up call from one of the most respected voices in the world. Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa has received the Nobel Peace Prize, the Gandhi Peace Prize, the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom, and the Albert Schweitzer Prize. A very different Schweitzer is what David James Duncan put in the parenthetical phrase. It's worth mentioning that few people alive today have offered solace to more people in the wake of grievous suffering. than Archbishop Tutu and his friend, the Dalai Lama. It's also worth mentioning that despite having soothed so many sufferers, when Tutu and the Dalai Lama have occasionally joined forces on stage, the sound of the Archbishop's flock of ecstatic birds' laughter, harmonizing with the earthquake guffaw of His Holiness, has swamped auditoriums with a delight so infectious that many listeners never recovered and have led lives of wild compassion ever since. In a fine new Kathleen Dean Moore edited anthology, Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril, Archbishop Tutu writes, leading environmental scientists predict that as many as 185 million Africans will die in this century as the direct result of climate change. Many more will face untold suffering in other parts of the world. Climate change is real, and the countries that are least responsible are paying the heaviest price. The average UK citizen produces nearly 50 times as much carbon dioxide as any citizen in the developing world. This is a serious injustice. As an African, I urgently call on ordinary people in rich countries to act as global citizens, not as isolated consumers. We must listen to our consciences, not to governments who speak only about economic markets. These markets will cease to exist if climate change is allowed to develop to climate chaos. And that's from Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I would just offer an aside to this. It's interesting that the discussion in the election of 2012 for the United States has nothing to do with anything that's important. It's just revolving around that issue of so-called economics. Amid the smog of tar sands boosterism, some phrases bear repeating. 185 million Africans dead from the effects of global warming this century. Economic markets cease to exist when climate change becomes climate chaos. Note that Tutu's writing is both altruistic and of dire consequence to good capitalists. The summer of 2010 was the hottest on record in some parts of the world and the wettest in others. A tornado struck Brooklyn and Queens. A flood in Pakistan killed 2,000. Deadly dispersants joined the rains in the Gulf Coast, and Governor Schweitzer's new friend, ExxonMobil, while committing acts of climate warfare globally, has paid millions on junk science and billions on lobbyists and campaign contributions, causing U.S. lawmakers to lag a half century or so behind the rest of the world in response to global warming. For a clear look, and this is a parenthetical phrase in the book here, at how big oil does this dirty work, see the Pulitzer Prize-winning angler, the Cheney vice presidency by Barton Gellman, and climate cover-up by James Hogan. Why should so many people sacrifice so much to create a Northwest and Northern Rockies tar sands tentacle? Here are Big Oil's three favorite reasons. One, to bloat the money pile known as ExxonMobil, already the richest company in the world. To employ the Korean steel workers ExxonMobil chose over Canadian steel workers, creating the transportation difficulties that have inspired their attempt to cram a tar sands tentacle through the greater Northwest. Three, to accelerate in Alberta the destruction of the living world at a pace so impossible to describe that I can only refer you again to the Peter Essek photos in the front of this book. And I'd encourage everybody to get a copy of The Heart of the Monster. Corporations, I do want to describe, though, the picture on page 12 just a little bit. It's amazing what's happening up there. And when one looks at these aerial photographs of the extensive damage and the sludge right next to the great Athabasca River, it's shocking. Corporations in this country are granted the rights of persons. Their money is granted the protections of free speech and given the power to buy elections via media brainwashing. But the powers that converted the boreal forest in Essex photo into the post-world in the second is neither human nor personal. An assault like this, if attempted by an actual person, would result in that person being arrested and imprisoned or shot as a terrorist in the act. ExxonMobil's plan to turn the Northwest and Northern Rockies into a tentacle of this destruction is not a form of speech, nor is it remotely democratic. Every friend and neighbor I have in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana is being not asked but told to serve the killing power of the tar sands by surrendering the rivers and roads of our home. There's a word for this kind of demand from on high, and it's not democracy. The people of the Northwest and Northern Rockies are being ordered to serve a dictator named ExxonMobil. He says in the next section, my power to protest this takeover is limited to a language known as English. A feeble prospect at first glance, I admit. But for all its rough and hypocritical edges, English is a wild sonic animal, dynamic, alive, thought-shaping. And there is an old British word that Americans creatively hijacked, commandeered, and refined to express the well-nigh inexpressible, the word wilderness. The etymology derives from Old English wildeor, a combination of wild and deer. And in England, I would add about the nest part, place of, and in England and in colonial times, the stock of this word was very low. For generations of manifest destiny spewing China tipping, tea-sipping empire builders, the root word wild meant out of control, uncivilized, savage, uncultured, rude, pagan, dirty, unreliable, bloodthirsty, bad-smelling, sexually nasty, and low-grade. And the innocent word wilderness was deemed guilty by association. John Bunyan, woefully I walk the wilderness of this world, Shakespeare, jailed by a wilderness of sea. How handy it would have been for the ExxonMobil, Shells, and BPs if things had stayed this way. But the word wilderness underwent a transformation in America, and that transformation has done nothing but bear fruit for two centuries. It thrills me in a patriotic, darn near flag-waving way that the meaning of wilderness is one that Americans as a nation almost single-handedly managed to transform. And as an aside, I would point out that the U.S. Congress is ready to repeal the Wilderness Act if the so-called and dishonestly named Sportsman Heritage Act passes. There are two versions, one that passed the House called H.R. 4089. We spoke about this earlier on the show, and one in the Senate called Senate 2066. Both bills are reprehensible and should be stopped. I would add that both bills have the support of the Idaho delegation, none of whom are friendly to wilderness or wild things. It's one that Americans as a nation almost single-handedly managed to transform. Starting with Thoreau, Emerson, Whitman, and the closet wild salmon lover, Emily Dickinson, and he has in quotes, exaltation is the going of an inland soul to sea. Achieving a more physical but still spiritual fervor in the Rhapsode, John Muir, taking on dominionists and embracing stewardship via the fearless Rachel Carson, revealing the cathedral-like allure of mountains via the vision of Ansel Adams, creasing in groundedness but maintaining reverence in the Zen hippie, Gary Snyder. Love of the wild has spread to the grassroots via the voices and work of more writers than I could name in a day. But even more, the love of wild has spread through the direct experience of the American wild itself. As John Muir put it, nothing can take the place of absolute contact, of seeing and feeding at God's table for oneself. The Lord himself must anoint eyes to see. My pen cannot. One can only see by loving. And that was from John Muir. The inhabitants of this continent wandered through its beauty. Fell so in love with their particular wild places and mass, they began under the visionary, and he has in parentheses with an explanation mark, Republican leadership of Teddy Roosevelt to preserve the best of our wild places as no nation ever had. What's more, when Americans tossed the old suspicion-ridden definition of wilderness back at Europe, a lot of Europeans cried, what the hell were we zinking? Vive le Jean Muir, kind of a cute little phrase there, and began restoring the wilds of their own nations. What is the revamped American definition of wilderness? I heard David Brower sum it up rather nicely just before he died. He said that thanks to a lifelong influence of the wild, at age 86, he was still just a gee whiz kid. Then he described his incredulity the first time he saw a wilderness spring at age 6. He was so mesmerized by the sight of what he called all that clean, clear water coming out of dirt that 80 years later, he still sounded gee-whizzy as he exclaimed, I couldn't understand how it could do it. Like so many wilderness lovers, he couldn't contain himself. Who invented all this life? The old man rhapsodized. All this beauty and mystery. Every wonderful thing that's out there. How did it all happen? Not in a civilization, in wildness. An even better testimony than Brower's for that kind of nature love you see in most Americans occurred in a questionnaire given to soldiers returning home after World War II. When asked, what did you miss most about your life in the United States? A full 60% of the returning GIs, all of whom I expected to shout women, topped the list with their favorite place to camp, hunt, and fish, the Wild of America. I'll start the next section. In the context of this abiding American reverence for wildness, it has been nauseating recently to read ExxonMobil's tar sands tentacle spokespersons gloating about about the money they're paying to upgrade 600 miles of America's wilderness-piercing mountain roads. This is rather like turning the Rosehill-Yellowstone Park into industrial conduits and asking to be thanked for it. The scenic byways through Idaho and Montana are among America's most beautiful. Crucial part of that beauty is their scale. The deer, elk, foxes, coyotes, eagles, ravens, bear, flocks of wild turkey and quail, moose and squirrels I so often encounter on these roads survive precisely because the roads are modest, curved, often steep, and must be driven with extreme but rewarding caution. ExxonMobil's self-styled $67.8 million in economic activity and spin-off benefits is a ludicrously self-serving description of what is causing big oil to convert gorgeous wild and scenic river-hugging byways into the most schizophrenic-looking industrial obstacle courses in American travel. I'll take another quick musical break here, play a little more from Mickey and the Motor Cars. I'll take a song here. Titled Rock Springs to Cheyenne. So here we go.
I don't think that I'll ever forget the winter of 72. It must have been the coldest year that I ever knew. I left my home in Dallas to head out for Idaho. Before I reached Colorado, I hit 3 feet of snow. Say hello.
Shut
We're back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Reading again from Heart of the Monster, the part by David James Duncan. And I'm going to skip a little bit, but read kind of an interesting part of the book, talking about the Selway Bitterroot. He's talking about, I guess, kind of a trip in memory of a friend that passed on, going into the Selway Bitterroot with another friend. Our destination was a tiny creek in a glacier cirque that has long since lost its glacier. It's one of the few creeks I know that remains so pure I'll drink from it. A few hundred yards from its origin spring, the creek dives over a 1,000-foot decline, vanishing into the most remote part of the Selway Bitterroot wilderness. I love this vanishing point. It feels like, is a gateway into the unknown. Liam had long since passed through such a gate. There's an inscription on the box containing the Buddha's ashes, placed there by his lovers. It reads, "You are the light, you are the refuge, no shelter but you." I spoke these words, then stood to say the most powerful prayer I know, one long ago learned by heart, brought home from India. It was a mild day, but as I was reciting the prayer, a remarkable wind came down and swirled around Brett and me so fiercely that I had to gulp air to keep the prayer coming. I thought of the broken pipeline that took Liam's breath. I had the fleeting sense of breath inside the breath, rushing in the sound of prayer to restore what had been taken. I felt and ease, despite the wind's power, felt a deep welcoming. So that was the experience that he had over a friend in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. I'm going to skip a few more pages here. And read some of the things about clean energy here. It says, "Those calling for clean, green, and compassionate energy future are hardly a splinter group. Financial, moral, intellectual, spiritual, political support for this mainstream movement is streaming into the world for thousands of faith leaders from universities all over the country, from literally millions of nonprofits and NGOs, from the wealthiest man in America, Bill Gates, from activist rockers like Bono and Eddie Vedder, and from an award-winning director despised by Brian Schweitzer for believing energy can and should be clean, James Cameron. The coalition includes past and current presidents and CEOs, millions of grassroots rabble-rousers, artists, students, organizations, and social justice organizations of every size and kind, many of whom have realized that our most pressing conservation issues and our public health concerns about smog, dying oceans, defiled beaches, defiled food, defiled birds and animals are the same one issue. The clean, green energy advocates, who also include a group of investors who hold the purse strings to more than $421 billion assets, much of it already invested in clean tech and green energy. These well-informed capitalists are making the case that if America does not change wholeheartedly into the burgeoning effort to wean the planet off fossil fuels, China and Europe will widen their lead in green development and millions of the best new jobs will pass the United States by." So those are some of the economic reasons that he gives for not going up the industrial highway and turning it into Highway 12, into that industrial highway. I'm going to play another quick song here from Mickey and the Motor Cars to help save my voice and come in for some conclusion here. So here we go, a little bit more music from Mickey and the Motor Cars.
Sure flies when you're young and on a roll. You think you're never growing old until that fateful day when it all slips away and you're waiting
for your future to unfold. If I could only see you, I might not ever leave you. Louisiana baby, if I could only let you know, I never wanna let you go. Louisiana baby, the wheels keep turning and I'm not done learning. I'm heading down to New Orleans today. And are you still down there? Do you even care? If I get the chance this time, I'm gonna stay. If I could only see you, I might not ever leave you. Louisiana baby, if I could only let you know, I never wanna let you go. Louisiana baby, it's not a small world after all. If I could only see you, I might not ever leave you. Louisiana baby, if I could only let you know, I never wanna let you go. Louisiana baby,
and we're back at the Wild Clearwater Country Show. I'm going to read The Heart of the Monster now, parts from it. From The Heart of the Monster, portion of The Heart of the Monster by David James Duncan. In The Heart of the Monster turns out to be a mound of basalt rubble about the size of a large but collapsed airplane hangar. Expansive riverside lawn surrounds a formation looking like a golf fairway that, instead of arriving at a putting green, leads to this ruinous-looking basalt heap. I've spent my life in the land of columnar basalt formations. I've never seen a more eerily smashed, anti-geometrical, godforsaken-looking heap of this orderly rock than the heart. That this rubble is the most important piece of mythological real estate in Nesper's country was bewildering. Basalt formations tend to dominate large landscapes, visibly underlying, connecting with one another. The heart has no discernible relationship with the land around it. This rubble pile looks more as if the dump truck the size of a ship descended from the heavens, dumped the basalt where it now lies, and drove away into the stars. I tend to mutter to inanimate things that interest and puzzle me. I found myself asking the big black heap questions like, how did you end up here, old monster heart? How did you get so wrecked looking? Why do you look like you don't belong here at all? The Nez Perce, it turns out, anticipate these kinds of questions and offer us mutterers help. About 100 feet shy of the heart heap, pitching wedge distance, the fairway led me to an unexpected object, a steel obelisk about the size of a hotel room refrigerator installed in the ground. This object, too, set me muttering, and again the Nez Perce had anticipated my reaction. Etched into the steel on top of the obelisk was a small coyote, and next to the coyote was a push button. This button startled me. In a place so isolated by a basalt heart so imploded, the button gave me the feeling that if I pressed it somewhere in the world, something might actually implode. It says a lot, maybe too much, about my trust of wild things like rivers, basalt rocks, and coyotes, that despite this feeling, I reached out at once and pushed the button. I waited for the sound of rumbling near a distance. I heard nothing, but strange to say, I felt a change in a way I can't describe it. I flew out in front of myself and sensed that something had indeed begun to implode, something huge and dark, something bigger than a tar sands module, even bigger than the tar sands itself, something so huge that even though I sensed that its implosion had begun, the complete collapse of this thing will take years. Then a man's voice began to speak. Nothing mysterious, the button had activated a tape recording in the obelisk. The man had the easygoing, uninflected, G-dropping accent of a tribal storyteller. He was telling the story of the heart of the monster. And, of course, I think everybody knows that story. But I'll read it as David James Duncan wrote it here. This all happened many years ago, long before the people came, when all the animals lived here. Once upon a time, Coyote was building a fish trap on the river when he learned that a great monster was eating all the animals. So Coyote set out to see what he could do. Along the way, he took a bath and dressed up to make himself look tasty to the monster. Climbing up the ridges, Coyote looked out over the land. Suddenly he saw a great head nodding off in the distance, behind a huge body. Coyote had never seen anything like it before. The monster could not see Coyote because he was painted brown like the swaying grass. Using rawhide ropes, Coyote tied himself to three big mountains, Pilot Knob, Cottonwood Butte, and Seven Devils. Then he called out to the monster, "Are you the one who swallowed all the animals? Why don't you swallow me too so I won't be lonely?" The monster did not know that Coyote carried with him a fire-making kit and five stone knives. The monster inhaled, making a mighty wind. He inhaled so hard that the ropes broke and Coyote was carried right inside the monster's gaping mouth. Coyote looked around as he walked down the wide throat of the monster, seeing many bones. He thought, many animals have been dying. Just then, Ohosni, the grizzly bear, rushed at him, roaring and growling. Coyote said, "So you make yourself scary only to me?" And he hit the bear hard in the nose. That is why grizzly has a short nose. As Coyote continued along toward the heart of the monster, Waktushna, rattlesnake, rattled at him threateningly. So only toward me you are vicious, said Coyote. Then he stepped on the snake's head and making it flat. It is still that way today. As Coyote walked further, the animals began to follow him. When he finally reached the heart of the monster, he built a fire with the flints he had brought, then saved some fat from the heart so the animals could eat. Smoke drifted up through the monster's eyes, ears, and nose. The monster didn't much like it. The animals ate the fat and watched. With his stone knives, Coyote had been slicing out the monster's heart. It was hard work. One by one, his knives began to break, but Coyote kept on cutting, kept the fire going too. When his last knife broke, Coyote grabbed the heart and tore it loose with his bare hands. That moment, the great monster died, and all the animals ran out the openings of the body according to Coyote's directions. Muskrat was last to come out. Everyone had stomped on him as he was caught by his tail. That's why to this day the muskrat has no hair on his tail. Everyone helped carve the fallen monster into large pieces. Coyote threw these pieces outward in every direction. Wherever they landed, nations of people sprang up, Coyote knowing them, Cayuse, Blackfeet, Coeur d'Alene, Yakima. When he finished, Fox came up and said, "What is the meaning of this, Coyote? You have used up the entire body of the monster and given it all to faraway lands. Is there nothing left for this place?" "Well," said Coyote, "why didn't you tell me this before? Bring some water." Coyote washed his bloody hands and sprinkled the drops on the ground right here. From this watered ground came the people Coyote named Nimipu, the Nez Perce. The heart of the great monster, now turned to stone, still lies here to mark the place of our beginning. So that's the story, the Nez Perce story. And then I will skip a little bit and kind of read sort of the last chapter. He also explores another myth, and this is the Irish and Scottish myths of the kings, the Gidaonan, and the heroes in the various cycles of Irish and Scots Gaelic mythology, and Bridget and some others. But I will conclude with kind of, we'll enter the story here. about a changed earth. Then Manannan, MacLir, ruler of the sea, saw that Bridge's cloak had spread over everything, but that great life was bulging up beneath the cloak, rising up to see what was happening. And Manannan reached for the sword of light and raised it over his head and waved it. And the great monstrous life drew back in one enormous wave, black and high, back, back, back into the sea. And he waved light sword again, and a smaller wave, violet and blue and more gentle, drew back, and waved the sword a third time, and a small wave formed, white crested and almost gentle, and the three waves of Ireland drew themselves into one and broke upon the shore. They looked at it. It changed new earth. They looked at it all as it lay there. Then Bridget said, I am going to lay the stone of destiny in the earth and let it stay, that the earth may have power. She laid the great stone on top of the earth, and it began to sink. And when it sank deep into the earth, a music sounded, and where it sounded, water flowed, and all the indentations and ruts and lanes Angus had dug in his play began to fill, till every river, lake, and stream was alive with water. And Angus cried, I want to stay here, I want to stay here and build things, I want to make things. I would like in this pool to make a smaller pool like the Well of Conla. I'd like to make silver fishes and gold ones and humpback and pink and green ones, large and small. And I'd like to make an orchard full of golden apples like those in Tirnanoke. And he concludes by saying, and that's one of the Irish creation myths, and that is the story of the creation of the earth, the Emerald Isle, the Isle of Destiny. Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana are a weave of places, weathery forces, flora and fauna, and wild intricacy, to which people from all the world flock like grateful birds simply to see earth being earth, see wildness intact, see the earth dreaming of beauty. Today we call these places ours, but the Northwest and Northern Rockies are a weave of life forms and mysteries we did not create and cannot recreate once the wild's ability to weave is ravaged. These great regions were pre-American and will be post-American. They are what enable biodiversity to diversify, natural selection to naturally select, and generation after generation of kids to muck around in river shallows with frogs, fingerlings, and caddisfly casings. These regions are governed not by such creatures as governors, but by elemental and celestial harmonies as powerful as earth spinning, yet as intricate as an orb weaver's dew-bedecked web. These places and forces, to put it to the ancient way, are our mother, the living terrain, her body, the floor, her clothes, the lakes, rivers, rills, her blood, arteries, the seasons and weathers, her moods, the birds, fish, fauna, humans, all equally her offspring. So I'll leave it at that and go to the weather. Looks like more of the same. Not much in the way of rain. Partly cloudy tonight. Thursday, partly sunny. Friday, partly sunny. Highs are going to be in the mid-60s to low 60s. Lows in the mid to upper 30s. Mostly sunny for the weekend, although by Sunday night it'll be mostly cloudy. Now we go to Between the Lines. You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
KRFP thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow 92.5 FM.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical